A small-time crime boss named Big Jim Kennelly came up with the idea in 1876. His best engraver of counterfeit plates, Benjamin Boyd, had been sentenced to 10 years in the state penitentiary in Joliet, Illinois. To pressure the governor to release him, Kennelly recruited two accomplices, including Jack Hughes, a former maker of counterfeit nickels, to kidnap Abraham Lincoln's body. For ransom, they would demand $200,000 in cash and a full pardon for ace counterfeiter Benjamin Boyd. In 19th century America, counterfeiting was a big problem. And despite today's high-tech printing with watermarks, embedded threads, and magnetic strips, counterfeiting is still very much with us. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. We're going to find out how counterfeiting affects our lives and how it pertains to game theory. And we'll find out about that and many other aspects of counterfeiting from Lona Smith, professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
Well, it has been a problem for a long time, certainly before the United States kind of regulated banknotes, I guess right after the Civil War. But I have, for example, here an 1878 counterfeit silver dollar, which is not something you would expect would be very practical to pursue, and yet there it is. So give us some idea of how big the problem has been and how big it is today.
It's an interesting crime because it's actually one that is specifically mentioned in the U.S. Constitution.
Is it?
Yes. And it took them a while, but more or less a few days before Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, he signed the act that created the Secret Service. And the Secret Service was...
Some irony there.
Some irony there. And it was only around 1901 or something like that that they acquired the protection of the presidency. So, yeah, it was... they had just started printing U.S. money around the start of the Civil War. And there was more or less, along with the North versus the South and the battlefield, there was a battle over counterfeiting. And so the U.S. was trying to counterfeit the Southern Confederate dollar out of existence, and that's still an expression, not worth a Confederate dollar.
Relatively easy to do. The Confederate paper money was pretty cheaply produced by the looks of it.
Yes, and even the U.S. dollar itself was being counterfeit quite a bit too. So come 1865, that was a very natural thing for them to do. Let's create an agency that's in charge of catching these guys.
Was there, though, not a standard U.S. currency before that? Were a whole bunch of like various state banks issuing money? Would that have made it much easier to counterfeit?
Much, much easier, yeah. So the U.S. dollar itself is more or less emerging around the Civil War in terms of a banknote. And they had all sorts of banknotes, i.e. every like 10,000 different banks offering their own notes. And you have to know a lot about a bank to know whether or not their note's good or bad. So unifying it all and creating the common U.S. dollar, well, that was the one of the creations of the Civil War.
How soon do we see counterfeiting of the standard U.S. dollar then?
Yes, I think that was immediately happening. It was wartime counterfeiting, though. And yeah.
And part of the purpose of that, I gather, and it's gone on into World War II and beyond, was to, devalue the currency of the enemy?
Yes, you don't. If you can't pay your soldiers, then they won't fight for you. So that seemed to be simple logic for them to follow, and they've done it since then. I mean, nowadays, it's pretty unheard of to try to counterfeit a currency out of existence because it's too hard. But back then, you know, if you think paper money started in around the late 1600s in Britain, but it's really tough to get it so that it's counterfeit proof to some reasonable approximation. So that really delayed the introduction of the U.S. currency, I think.
At what point did they bring in something like watermarks, which were supposed to make it more difficult?
So I'm not certain the exact timing. This is all 20th century. And, I mean, right now they have, or for the longest time, they've had very special paper with raised dots and...
The cotton threads, I think they are.
Cotton threads, that sort of paper. And... The ace counterfeiters of like 30, 40 years ago, they discovered that either newspaper One of the counterfeit guys, counterfeit millionaires, who served 12 years, but now he's a famous artist. He was using the Chicago Sun-Times newspaper
for counterfeit currency.
Yeah, the key thing is it has to pass the wand test. So there's special paper that'll do that, and another one is telephone. There used to be telephone books. That sort of paper would pass the wand test. So,
but literally, don't American bills have to? Don't you have to be able to launder them, literally speaking, and have them come out still spendable?
So you're talking about the cloth. I mean, our currency is made of cloth, mm-hmm. and I don't know to what extent these guys were really caring about that, because it's really impressive. If you go to a bank, I've talked to many bank tellers, they're just rifling through money in their hands really fast. There's all these counterfeiting features, and I've talked to so many of them. I said, what are you looking for? And they said, just the feel.
Just the feel.
Yes.
So they must be very sensitive then if they can tell in the course of, let's see, there'd be, what, a $50, $100 bills in a pack, and to pick out the one or two that would feel slightly different, they must be very familiar with the feel of money by the time they can accomplish that.
Yes, and somewhat overconfidently too, because you can get, in foreign countries, you will get counterfeit money issued by ATMs. Even in the United States, you'll have some ATMs issuing counterfeit money. So it will go through the system. And there's a lot of counterfeits, the highest quality counterfeits, that are only ever discovered by the U.S. Federal Reserve.
And how would they? Because, I mean, the Federal Reserve has got to be very busy, too, with lots of large denomination bills.
Right. This is where basically money goes to die. So, you know, the typical $1 bill lives a life of around 14 months, and then it dies, and they burn it up in their fireplace. But before that, they go and check these things out. And the $100 note will live about 8 years before it dies. And so they're doing some forensics on the money there before they burn it all up. And that's where they've discovered a lot of counterfeits that have gone right through the system, including most of the counterfeit $1 bills.
Counterfeit $1 bills. Is the advantage there just because it's less likely that anybody would bother to check a $1 bill, but you have to make 100 times more than you would for a C note?
Exactly. So you're kind of tracing the logic that's in the game that I outlined. So, you know, I set up a game that, and it turns out that, yes, people are not going to be looking at the $1 notes very much. And it would predict exactly what's happening, that these things they're going through this circulation. No one's looking at them. And the Federal Reserve is catching most of the counterfeit $1 notes.
Do you have a sense of how much at any given time, how much counterfeit money there is circulating in this country?
It's a little bit difficult to answer, because, you know, this is something we only see the outflow. We see money that's being seized from the bad guys. We see money that's being caught as being passed. And the official numbers are roughly correct, which is around 1 in 10,000 notes. So the U.S. Dollar, I think there's around 2.3 trillion U.S. dollars circulating in the world right now. And if you think 1 in 10,000 are being found to be counterfeit, that's saying that this year, somewhere around 230 million, something like that, dollars will be found to be counterfeit. But that's just the exits from the pool. Now, how long were those counterfeits changing hands? That's obviously a much larger number.
How cost efficient is it? How cost effective then for anybody to take the time to look for a counterfeit bill? I think didn't you figure it was a remarkably more efficient, economical than we would think?
Yes. So the $100 note in the model that I wrote down, you could, which made sense of the data, and then you kind of back out what was it saying that people were expending in time, and it was for the $100 bill, a quarter of a cent of attention.
And, that's a pretty good return.
And for the $1 bill, like 1/2000th of that. And it was in writing this paper that really made me believe in economics, because this was not merely microeconomics, this was nanoeconomics. Astoundingly tiny costs were completely predictive of the levels of the counterfeit notes seized and passed. So,
can you tell us in a cogent way than how you apply game theory to the economics of counterfeiting?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, all the world is a game. And whenever, if there's ever any data that you're seeing out there that involves human choice, the only way to understand it is with a game. So game theory is the analysis of any situation where people's choices impact outcomes. And as an economist, we assume that your choices are motivated, that you have some objective. And the objectives that seemed reasonable to me is that counterfeiters would want to maximize their profits. And people face this dual objective. They'd like to not be caught holding counterfeit notes, because the rule is, if you're ever caught with counterfeit notes, if you then go and try to pass them, that's a crime called uttering. It's knowingly passing a forged document. It's a tough crime to prosecute.
Because how do you know it's knowing?
Right. And so you almost never see prosecutions of it. But the Secret Service on their webpage, they really make you worried that you're ever going to commit this crime. So, if you're at a cash register and you pass a note and they do the wand test on it, or someone has the insight that this is counterfeit, at that moment, the protocol that Secret Service has told American merchants is you have to immediately contact the police or them and hold this person in your store, because they want to know where this stuff came from. This is a cost that you are worried about. And if you think it's a 1 in 10,000 event, then there's that 1 in 10,000 event that you're worried about. On the other hand, it's a cost or a hassle to be looking at notes.
And if you have, in good faith, let's say, gotten this $100 bill and accepted it, and then you try to pass it, again, unknowingly, at some business, and you're flagged, you're just out $100?
Correct. That's the rule. And so what people will then frequently do is they'll try to find a greater fool. And so the transactions that occur in the dark, in taxi cabs late at night, in shady establishments, are much more likely to have counterfeit notes.
And how then does the Secret Service, I guess it would be, go about tracking somebody who might be the 50th person to pass this note?
Right. So if you're more than one link down the chain, then I think that you're a lost cause to them. But they're hoping they're going to catch people closer up. I mean, that when there was this one guy, Art Williams, who was caught, and he was almost boasting. He'd made all this recent counterfeit money. He brought it back to his dad in Alaska, and they started sharing it around. And it immediately got to the local office that there was a counterfeit note here, and they knew it was from the guy, and that there was his son. But they make this incredibly bold claim, or at least they used to make this claim, that they catch 99% of all the counterfeiters.
That's
which is pretty brash.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but anyway, so the main cost for counterfeiters is laundering it. You make a lot of money, but if you had lots of counterfeit money with you right now, and you start spending it on State Street, within an hour, the Secret Service is going to be talking to people.
They're, that fast?
Oh, yeah. They are really quick. They're on the scene. They'll either, you know, one of their guys or the local police, they're on the scene and they're interviewing, okay, where did you get this from?
You do have to wonder a little bit about the economics for counterfeiters then, because it seems that in order to be successful at getting away with it, they would have to spread the money around a lot.
Correct.
Which, of course, then raises another risk, is that there's more places that are likely to catch it, too. How does that work?
Yeah. So I think this is the main cost of counterfeiting, is the laundering of it. And they will use middlemen. I'm not certain of the exact logistics, but I do know that, you know, I think a life of a counterfeiter is, you know, 5 or 10 years of glorious fun, living way beyond your existence, and then 5 or 10 years in the prison.
you mentioned this one counterfeiter was using paper from the Chicago Tribune, which
yes,
is kind of boggling in itself. But take us through the steps of counterfeiting money.
So in the theory that I did, I realized I couldn't explain all of the facts without allowing the counterfeiters a choice of how good a counterfeit to make. And it turns out that the lower the denomination notes, the lower the quality of the counterfeit. So when they first came out with inkjet printers, it didn't take too much time before all sorts of, I don't know, college students, whatever, realized they could literally make money. And so you don't want to counterfeit the $100 notes because those will be looked at very carefully. So they'd come in at the $5 and the $10 notes. And then before long, then the U.S. Government, I don't know which arm of it, started mandating that all inkjet printers would write little microdots on it. So every single page that you print out, they can source it. If you ever...
Wow.
Yes.
And at what point then do these bills start getting better?
It seems that the... the Secret Service is under the, in my opinion, benighted view that the $20 bill is the most counterfeit note. And there's a lot of pretty good counterfeiters. There was a book, The Counterfeit Millionaire, that came out, and the guy just did 20s. So I think that the 20 is the first high-quality note. There's all sorts of artisans, I believe, in Colombia, that they'll only come in at the $50 note. And
it's good to have a specialty.
Yes. And the $100 note, people look at very carefully. And so there you get the state actors having awesome counterfeit $100 notes. So if you read about the Super Note, which was produced by North Korea, they solved the problem of getting the right feel for a note by getting $1 notes, blanching them.
Uh-huh.
And now you got a great template for a note. And they managed to seize some... There's a raised printing technology. It's an Italian word, intaglio. I don't speak Italian. That gives the raised printing feel. And they got one of those printers. And so they make the Super Note or the Super Dollar. And these counterfeits are so good, they're basically only caught by the U.S. Federal Reserve.
And they're using what denomination, the Koreans?
They would start with a one because you want to maximize your profits.
Right.
And so they're taking a $1 loss.
Oh, and blanching all of these
blanching
ones.
All the one, and now sure. they go printing the $100 on it.
How do they get, or do they even bother to change the serial numbers?
I bet you they're making them up. I mean, there's a lot of features on a note, but the serial numbers are all differing across notes.
They are. Okay, so there's some kind of sequence rather than the same serial number
yes.
for 100 notes.
That seems to be the easiest thing that people are never going to notice, not even a bank, because who knows what the serial number should be.
But if you start having happen to notice that you have two or three with the same serial number, you know something is like having five aces in a deck of cards.
Ah, yes. Now, I haven't looked at a serial number on a note since who knows when, so.
And these would probably still only last whatever it is, 14, 18 months. So they'd be gone before a lot of people would catch it, right?
Yeah. So the higher the denomination, the longer it lives. If you think of what happens to a $1 note, it is your default change. So it lives in your wallet and dies very quickly. And so
it's all folded up.
It's all folded up. It's ratty. Who knows what germs are on it? And so it lives around 14 months, and it's gone. Whereas the $100 note, the life expectancy, according to the Federal Reserve, is around 7.8 years.
Still that long, because $100 doesn't go as far as it used to.
Yes. So it's strange that people are holding on to it. But this is why the Secret Service or the Federal Reserve is messed up on. They think that the 20 is the most counterfeit note because they're seeing that in a given year, the fraction of 20s that they know that are out there that are showing up as counterfeit is larger.
Sure.
But these 20s, you know, they're living 3.8 years or something like that, that they are in exchanges lots. And so a typical $100 note might change hands, you know, once or twice in a year, and a $20 note is changing hands five or six times. So out of those five or six times, it is ahead of the $100 note. But on a per transaction basis, undeniably, the $100 note is the most counterfeit note.
And it's also, I guess, the most popular with, international drug trade and that kind of thing, because it doesn't take up as much space to have $100 notes. But on the other hand, it would seem unlikely that you would conduct some kind of an illicit deal with a bundle of counterfeit money. Wouldn't you mix it in or something? How does that usually work? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. I do know that the fact that the U.S. currency is abroad and, you know, foreigners don't know our currency as well as we know our currency increases the counterfeiting rates. But probably if you are dealing with a drug dealer and you do pay in counterfeit money, you're putting your life at risk too.
In addition to putting your life at risk just in general, even if you're using bona fide currency. We're going to look further at this phenomenon of counterfeiting and look at it on the international scale. And eventually, we're actually going to tie this game theory that my guest has applied to counterfeiting. We're going to apply it to the pandemic before this hour is over. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Lona Smith, a professor of economics at the UW-Madison, and he has done considerable research into counterfeiting and has applied game theory to predicting some aspects of counterfeiting. And that would include changes in which denominations are most likely to be counterfeited at any time?
Yes. Yeah, so the facts are that the counterfeiting rates are rising in the denomination. And there was also a type of counterfeit money that's important. The some counterfeit money is seized from the bad guys. It's called seized money. And most of the counterfeit money nowadays is called past counterfeit money. It's caught in the hands of an unwitting person, hopefully unwitting person. So that's something that has totally changed in proportion in the last half century.
How so and why?
So in 1970, there was a big boast. I was looking at microfiche in the library, and you could see the presentations to the Congress, and they'd beat their chest that they were catching 90% of all the counterfeit money before it hit circulation. It was 90% was seized. Now, when they go to before Congress, they never mention what they're doing because they're only catching 10% of it.
Ouch. Okay. Why the shift?
So if you understand the modeling basically is saying that counterfeiters are trying to make profits and people are sitting there trying to, they're engaged in this calculation of how much attention to pay, that for the counterfeiters, if there's a technological change that perhaps could kind of democratize counterfeiting, like for instance happened with the inkjet printer, then the only way to balance the incentives of everyone, ensure that they still keep on making profits, is that there's a much higher success rate of passing your money into circulation. So that's what happened. The technological change happened, and now the situation we're in is that we're not in the era of 1970 where there's like a few big counterfeiters, large-scale operations. We have thousands of counterfeiters.
Just a little kind of like basement counterfeiters.
Yes. Everyone, the idea that you could make money, that thought crosses so many minds, and then some people just decide to act on it.
What kind of equipment would these people need?
The right type of paper.
Right.
And an inkjet printer and a sufficiently inattentive person that you're passing the money to.
That's interesting. What would be your strategy for that, to find the right kind of inattentive person?
I would, again, try to do it in the dark or try to do it in a dollar store, someone who has very low incentives to get it right. There's some stores that have policies of they're only going to use the wand, the little marker to test counterfeits if it's a $100 note. So if you know that that's a threshold, then you don't go to the store for that. So they learn the protocols of the stores.
Is it pretty routine in stores to use the wand on a $100 bill?
I think, yeah. Whenever I've seen $100 notes, out comes the little... Because you can buy these on Amazon. I was just checking today. For $24, you can get a pack of them.
Well, before we go further on this, a little alcove here in our travels having to do with counterfeiting, somebody who, like Joe on the street, who's not adept at handling lots of money like a cashier or a banker, how would he or she go about identifying like a counterfeit $100 bill, say?
Well, the fact is they don't.
They don't?
I mean, I think that the U.S., it's the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, is not optimizing. They have all sorts of features there.
Yeah, they've got the strips now.
Strips, color shifting ink, watermarks. It's really impressive, but it's useless if people don't notice it. And, you know, the most successful innovation ever in this cat and mouse game between bad guy and good guy was the introduction of color on notes in Canada. And it was in 1973, the Bank of Canada started printing, the currency in Canada went color.
Sure. Yeah. $1 bill, $2 bill, $5,
$10, yes.
Each one like monopoly money, each one a different color.
And we had the data on the counterfeit notes in Canada. And then suddenly you can see in from 1973 to 76, the counterfeiting dropping 99%. Because here was something that the counterfeiters couldn't figure out how to do. They couldn't figure out how to put color on it, and everyone would notice it.
And, true, yeah.
And this is, all these features, if you have a fancy feature that no one notices, then it doesn't really reduce the counterfeiting rate.
That is something you would notice right away, especially in this country where, to my knowledge, we've never had color distinction from one denomination to another.
Correct. We now have we've got a color number in the bottom right corner of a lot of these notes, color shifting ink there. But yes, it's the U.S. dollar. You know, it's the greenback. but yeah, color on the notes. Unfortunately, you couldn't do that now because I think you know we have inkjet printers that'll produce color, and the bad guys have figured this one out. But yeah, so that's the best thing that you can ever do is exploit low attention people handling your notes, and color did it. I don't know what else would do it besides color.
It would certainly be the most noticeable. Although, again, speaking of Canada, this wouldn't work too well with your higher denominations. But of course, they have the dollar coin, the loonie, they have the toonie, and then they have the, instead of just the milled edge, which is what American coins have from the dime up through, they have multi-sided. And they also have two different metals in the $2 Canadian coins.
They do. It's a bimetallic coin.
So how is Canada doing with their counterfeiting? Are they still, 99% reduction?
The counterfeiters caught on. But nonetheless, Canada more or less is in the business of making currencies for other countries. So I think it makes the currencies for 25 other countries. And they have, you know, a Canadian note, if you get a hold of Canadian money, it's really cool. They got a hologram in the middle. You can't miss it. Whereas the U.S. features are very easy to miss. I think they have this insane devotion to the greenback, and they want to keep it that way.
Yeah, so something what applies stability or something like that if it hasn't changed for 150 years or something.
This idea that we're not monopoly money, and you hear people talk about the money of a currency of every other country, and they'll say, that's monopoly money. But well, it'd be good if it was.
I did see some of the fairly recent efforts at colorizing American money is being described as looking like a laundry room accident because it was, you know, they made a point of making it kind of all blotchy.
Ah.
Not too many years ago. Well, you know, the United States of America with all this technology and certainly plenty of incentive, are they caught between a rock and a hard place, the rock being tradition, the hard place being counterfeiting, or is it just not even worth it to change overall again for the amount of money that's being counterfeit?
I think that they're more or less thinking that one in 10,000 notes, which is their claim, which is the outflow of notes, probably the stock is much higher, maybe it's more like five, but one in 10,000 notes counterfeit is okay.
It's just kind of a loss that you're willing to take.
It's absolutely. And it's regular. It's really, if you want to believe in the laws, stability, the laws of human nature, just look at the stability in the levels of counterfeit notes year after year. It restored my faith in economics that incentives were so predictive and
Well, let's get back to this notion of game theory then and predicting what kind of counterfeiting we would expect in this country from year to year.
Okay, so in a game, everybody takes an action. Everybody cares about optimizing some objective, presumably. And the actions that counterfeiters are taking is making counterfeit notes. The actions that people are taking is verifying, carefully looking at these notes. So the more counterfeiters make money, the higher is the counterfeiting rate, the more carefully people will look at it. But then if people are looking at more carefully, this makes it less profitable for people to be counterfeiters. And so this is why it's stable.
Kind of seesaws back and forth.
It seesaws back and forth. And so it's a very stable equilibrium between the people verifying, looking at notes. And the interesting thing also is if you also allow them to make different qualities of counterfeits, then you can have that you can predict the quality should be rising over time. And that's a very stable thing too. So... yeah, so game theory, which goes back, at least the version that I'm using here, goes back to 1951 with John Nash, assumes that everybody's optimizing and asks, is there a stable outcome when everybody's optimizing, taking is given when everyone else is doing? And John Nash, you know, of a beautiful mind, he showed that, yes, there's always at least one stable outcome that's, we call it self-enforcing, where everyone is optimizing, taking is given when everyone else is doing. And that's the unifying concept for all the social sciences because it works in so many settings. And
is that the kind of thing the Treasury Department is likely to adopt?
I don't think they really have any theorists on board. they didn't even have people who understood this idea of stocks and flows, that there's a stock of money and there's a flow, and perhaps we're seeing the manifestations of that flow at a much higher frequency for $20 notes than for $100 notes. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of sophisticated theoretical thinking going on there.
I get from what you've said already, Lonas, that the impact on the U.S. economy of counterfeiting really isn't that great.
I don't think it is. I think there's a lot of people who are taking losses. They tend to be establishments that often don't have a lot of... power, maybe racetracks and things like that, betting houses. So people are taking losses, but it doesn't ever impact the faith in the U.S. Currency because it stays at this stable low level. We're not going back to an era of the Civil War where it was a third. I mean, 1 in 10,000, or even if it's, I think the stock is more like maybe 3 or 5 in 10,000 is good enough.
And you're saying also that kind of the era of the large counterfeiting firms is over. It's all kind of basement printing presses.
Certainly for everything below $100 notes. But there's some collections of artisans around the world, in particular in Colombia, I believe that they have these specialists who specialize in making 50s and 100s. This is their life. You know, you're someone, you're just a great artist. Just like the millionaire I was talking about who got caught in Alaska, he's now an artist. So you're a great artist and you decide, I'm just going to draw money.
Well, the time was not all that long ago in this country that it was illegal even to have a photograph, wasn't it,
correct.
Piece of currency?
You cannot, if you want to photograph a U.S. currency, it either has to be enlarged by like 50% or shrunk by a third. They have very strict rules.
It might be a little hard to enforce those with all these people able to make high-class photographs just, as hobbies or for the fun of it. I mean, it's
yes.
So easy now, the technology for everybody.
I imagine that there's a lot of people who are getting visits from the Secret Service who are told, that's not cool.
Really? So,
yes.
Yeah. If I were to go out with I won't say a cell phone, but maybe something with even higher resolution than that.
Yeah.
Take a picture of a $20 bill, post it online.
Online, it's hard to determine what the size is, but once you've printed it onto paper.
Oh, okay.
Then that they have these rules for how much it has to not look like a U.S. dollar.
Wow. Also hard to enforce. I'm wondering what the counterfeiters are doing for the magnetic strips, though.
They might not need them. If we don't, remember, if people don't notice it, they don't need to put it there.
Still that. Well, and I suppose also there's a little bit of liability. If the Treasury Department is changing things up fairly often to catch the counterfeiters, then that lack of consistency would make it kind of invisible to the everyday user. In other words, if they're used to seeing it different every time they're passing a $100 bill, they wouldn't notice, oh, there's no magnetic strip or this, that, or the other, because the change would be too fast, I mean, too frequent.
Yeah, the change is pretty infrequent now. I think that they'll go for over a decade with one particular style of a note before changing it up. And they're always, they say they want to make it higher security, but again, they're missing out on the critical human element.
When was the last time you heard of a counterfeiter being arrested in this country?
I mean, periodically you'll just see in the news X was counterfeiting. I presume that anyone who is caught with counterfeit money, they're going to prison. It could be for a very short time. The problem in Canada is that they had this fantastically successful counterfeiter who was so successful, he put the Canadian $100 bill out of business. This was around 20 years ago. There was a period of time that if you were around Michigan or whatever, you're told, do not accept under, they'll say, no Canadian $100 bill is accepted. So he literally put it out of business, and because he was so successful. And when they finally caught him, they more or less gave him a slap on the wrist, and he ended up with a high-paying bank job, because now he's their head of counterfeiting.
working for the other side. It wouldn't be the first time that sort of thing has happened. We're going to see how this game theory applied to counterfeiting has also been applied by my guest to the pandemic, and making some predictions there as to how the handling of the pandemic would come out. That, when we return, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Lona Smith, who is a professor of economics at the UW-Madison. We've been applying, he has been applying, game theory to counterfeiting, of all things, to determine in part how to expect counterfeiters to react from one time or another to the securities that the governments employ to counteract the counterfeiters. But having gone through a bit of that, we've also promised to talk about how game theory can be applied to the pandemic. And we're talking about COVID here. And whatever got you into that, Lonas?
So my co-author was insistent that this passing infection person to person was like passing counterfeiting, except when you get rid of a counterfeit note, you've lost it. Whereas when you get rid of a disease, you still have it. But aside from that, you face the same incentives. You're interacting with someone. Something's going to change hands. You're worried that you're going to get something bad. And so you're going to be taking extra cautions. And in a counterfeiting model, if there's a high counterfeiting rate, you're going to be looking very carefully. If there's a high dollar value, you're going to be looking very carefully. Here in the pandemic, as the contagion rate, as the prevalence went up, people got more and more cautious, same incentives. And if we go across people in the population, young versus old, the old people at any given level were more and more cautious, like a high dollar note.
Interesting comparison there. And at what point in the pandemic did you come up with this application?
Well, it was actually, the model started in before the swine flu epidemic. And so my co-author was grabbing data from state administrators on that. And it took a long time to get that data and just to formulate the model properly. But then when this, actually the research was funded by the National Science Foundation in January of 2020, and then the pandemic started.
I was going to say, that's quite something for timing.
Yes. So, and what was interesting was that all these predictions were coming down about here's what's going to happen to the pandemic. And I used to see Elizabeth Birx in the White House making these predictions. And I knew it was all completely outrageously wrong. I mean, if you look at the graph that she's holding up, she's predicting the pandemic is over in July 2020 with some astounding number of people just suddenly dying. And I'm thinking, what about human behavior?
That's always the wild card, isn't it?
Yeah. So,
irrational behavior even.
Yeah. So all these people were claiming we're going to have exponential growth. No, we didn't have exponential growth ever. If you just look at the plots, it was right from the beginning, you could see behavior slowing things down. Right, like on day 18.
In terms of the number of people getting COVID?
Right from the beginning, if it was growing exponentially, you could plot it in a logarithmic graph and be a line, and it's just dropping off. So undeniably, it's called the SIR model, and the SIR model treats people like we're animals with invariant behavior. Mm-hmm. But people are smarter than animals, and people read the news. And when they would learn that, hey, this disease is getting more and more prevalent in my area, they started pushing harder and harder. You know, they would cancel meetings. They wouldn't go out to restaurants, et cetera. And so anyways, we have a model here that is a nice modification of the SIR model, the very tractable, but it is no longer exponential. It's about geometric behavior. So
because people are constantly adjusting.
Yes, and the worse things get, the more the passing rate slows down. So the SIR model would say if there's twice as many people out, I suppose the prevalence today is double what it was last month, then they would say that the new infections would be double. But no, they're not double. They only would rise, they'd shade off by 20%. So if the prevalence doubles, the new cases would only go up by 80%.
So too many variables in there, really, to predict accurately how the pandemic would increase.
Right. So I made a kind of a heroic economic assumption. In economics, we assume all these demand curves that are very well behaved, that assume that whenever a price goes up by 10%, your demand goes down by a fixed percent.
Hmm, yeah.
They're called constant elasticity demand mm-hmm. curves. And if you make that same assumption for how people behave with goods, with how they allocate their vigilance, I called it, to the pandemic, then you end up getting a completely solvable model that is was fitting all the data, which...
Yeah. Can you actually do that, though? Because the difference between whether you're going to buy the widget or not, and whether you're going to get COVID and maybe die or not, there's a more radical investment in your behavior.
So the question is, what is the technology of reducing interactions? And are people, you know, people who would shift from an in-your-face meeting to a Zoom meeting? People would wear a mask. People do all these things. And so, yeah, what is that technology? It seemed to be kind of a nice assumption to assume that it behaved like any other product. But the taste of the pudding is in the test. Test of the pudding's in the taste. And it exactly fits the data. And you could see that the pandemic was going to last a long time. You could see that you were never going to have exponential growth. You can see exactly how people get more and more vigilant as it gets worse, and less as it gets attenuates.
What did you do with that prediction that game theory applied to COVID?
Well, right now, I'm just trying to write up the paper here. right now, I'm trying to offer a new benchmark model for all these biologists who don't know economics, don't know human behavior, so that they can, because what you really want when you're working in the field is just an off-the-shelf model so you can make a reasonable prediction. For instance, there's a big question, if a government has a policy, like they were locking down, they were closing schools and whatever, they'd put mask rules. Would people so overreact to that policy that it would be counterproductive? So, for instance, maybe if you're wearing a mask, you think I can be in any meeting and the actual infection rate would go up.
Sure. Yeah. Interesting.
So this is actually something that emerged in thinking about auto accidents a long time ago, which is another application of this. I'm doing these games. They're massively multiplayer games where people have to exert a vigilance. And when you're driving, you exert a vigilance too. And we know that, the auto accident rate, for instance, declined since the beginning until around 2012, and then it started going up again because people weren't as vigilant because of phones.
Right.
So this sort of context is ideal for thinking about whether or not a government policy could be counterproductive. And I had a professor in Chicago in grad school. His name was Sam Peltzman, and he has an effect named after him, the Peltzman effect, which is the ultimate in Chicago economics, which is trying to say that governments are benighted forces. And he would say that when seatbelts or airbags or all these different mandatory safety devices came into cars, that there would just be this overreaction. Oh, I'm driving a seatbelt. I can drive more recklessly.
Oh.
And he verified it because he found out that every time there was a safety innovation, pedestrian deaths would go up.
Oh, pedestrian deaths because the people in the cars were not going to be as vigilant.
Absolutely. But Sam Peltzman was going even further and saying maybe not only were the pedestrians on the off the side of the road dying more often, but the drivers themselves would. And that was definitely false. And so in the model that I have, there is no Peltzman effect. Even though he's my professor, you can see that there is a reduction. You know, if the environment gets 10% safer, people will relax, kick back. And so it'll only be actually 8% safer.
And so that would apply to COVID, wouldn't it? Because, oh, yeah, the incidence has gone down. It's safe to come back out. I've waited too long to go out to dinner or whatever it is. And then there's this kind of backwash of resurgence.
Yes. So this is the generic idea known as risk compensation. To what extent do people compensate or even overcompensate for changes in the risk in the environment? And I would say that all the government rules, they were not counterproductive. They could have not been justified by cost-benefit analysis. That's another question. But if you're ignoring all the other costs, they all had the effect of reducing the passing. And you can see this in the data. Every time there was in the COVID, every time there was a lockdown, the passing rate would dip.
So it's really important and in some ways very difficult to make an absolute mathematical prediction because you have this not entirely rational element of human behavior, of human reaction to any given phenomenon.
So economists like treating everybody as if they're maximizing, even regarding death.
Assuming that they're doing what's best for them.
Yes.
Which is probably not a valid assumption always, is it?
Yeah, okay, so I'm being totally predictive.
Look at prohibition, for example,
Oh,
yeah.
Very unwise
policy. We know
it's
good for you not to drink, and so
absolutely.
Everybody will stop drinking.
Oh, absolutely, and it had a tremendous increase in the death rate. But I'm just going to say that human behavior is very predictive here. And what's interesting, you can see here's why you want to treat it as a game. You care about not only the payoffs you're facing, you care about everyone else's actions. And you can see this, for instance, in my work on the auto on applying this to auto accidents. Whenever, say, Friday night and Saturday night hits, more people are drunk on the roads. And now you go and look at people getting into accidents. And it turns out that there's very few people who are driving drunk. We're talking about under 1%, certainly under 5%. So most car accidents should be involving non-drunk people. But you can see that the rate that non-drunk people are crashing into each other goes down, really significantly goes down on Friday and Saturday nights because they're driving more cautiously because they anticipate that there are other drunks out there.
Well, that's a fascinating kind of backlash thing.
Yes. Yeah, so this is game theory is great at seeing how people interact with each other and with the payoffs. And it's interesting to see how people are understanding these incentives when they drive, when they're in the pandemic, when you're dealing with counterfeiting notes.
How would you apply that then finally to automotive safety, let's say?
So Sam Peltzman did it as he was trying to attack regulation. He had this bee in his bonnet. He was in Chicago. Chicago's my academic great-great-grandfather is Milton Friedman.
Oh.
Yes. So they had their bee in the bonnet about saying that government policy has the law of the unintended consequence. But I would say, yes, there is an unintended consequence, but if you're rational, it's fully understood that it'll happen, but it's never going to erase the direct effect. The direct effect is the dominant one, and if a government comes in and mandates a car is safer, you know, yes, they were always over-predicting. My professor was making this point that they were over-predicting lives saved. You'd figure out how many people were dying in car accidents by smashing into their steering wheel, and what happens if we made the steering wheel collapsible, which they did. And then they found out that the deaths were not going down as much as they thought. Yes, they were not going to go down, but they still went down.
Still went down. Makes you wonder about motorcycle helmet laws, too.
Yes, those are tricky. Motorcycle helmet laws, I think, are a no-brainer. The bicycle helmet laws have this other weird effect, because when you are a cyclist and you're wearing a helmet, cars drive closer to you, and that undeniably increases your death rate.
Wow.
And that's a really perverse game theoretic aspect, but it's true.
Not enough to make you not want to wear a helmet, though.
Probably not, but I'd be wary of cars when I'm driving a bike.
either way, yeah, it was fascinating how these intended consequences do have backlashes, and as you say, Lonas, still doesn't overturn the major effect, though.
Yes. So this is one giant game. We're playing a game of substitutes. We call it strategic substitutes in game theory. The more vigilant you are in washing your hands in the pandemic, the less I have to be. The more vigilant you're driving, the less vigilant I can drive. On the other hand, for counterfeiting, it's the opposite. The more vigilant I think you're going to be in looking at the notes that I hand you, the more vigilant I'm going to be in looking at the notes that I'm handed. So these big concepts help create the games that you use to analyze them.
Wow, you must be fun to play Monopoly with. Well, thanks for being with us today, Lonas Smith.
Okay, thank you very much.
Fascinating stuff. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around. Our engineer is Tom Blaine, and this is University of the Air.